Ο Νάσο.
So as we come to the end of the week, we come almost to the end of our cycle, returning to awareness of awareness, or shamatha without a sign. And as I've mentioned before, among all the shamatha practices we're exploring, and among all shamatha practices generally, this is the one that is most, how do you say, most explicitly takes the fruition as the path. A phrase that's very common in Vajrayana, which is to simply to say, not that it is Vajrayana by itself, it's not. It's common to all of the Shravakayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. But in the sense that the method itself is so similar to the destination, or to the fruition, the culmination of the path. And the culmination of the path, of course, is just a little path from coarse mind to dissolving the mind into substrate consciousness. Now, once you've achieved shamatha, and your mind is completely dissolved into the substrate consciousness, there's a type of symmetry there, a type of non-differentiation, of just evenness, just sheer luminosity, no object. Just, there it is. Bliss, luminosity, non-conceptuality. The knowing is right there. It's right in the nature of awareness. Awareness is knowing. And that's it. It's just completely homogeneous. Or there's a nice word from physics. There's a quality of symmetry there. Right. And then you may at will arouse, catalyze, set that substrate consciousness into motion. And when that happens, the symmetry is broken. And then you may direct your attention to the past and so forth. But as that symmetry breaks, as that just sheer evenness breaks, as that is jolted, so to speak, then what comes out of that, the first and the most primitive impulse coming out of that, is, any guesses? Klishtamana. You're about to say, yes, exactly, klishtamana. Yes, you're right. You're right, exactly right. I don't know where you're going from there, but I think you are right. Sure, this coagulation, this sense of this ahamkara, the eye-maker, the klishtamana, the afflictive cognition, and it's very primitive, it's very base, it's very primal. It's not articulate, not conceptual. It is just this kind of congealing, this coagulation, this drawing, this sense of being over here, and now there's something over there, and we're looking at just the first tiptoe out of the substrate consciousness, the first little venture, the first step of the venture. And what you're attending to is the substrate. And in a very primitive way, the substrate's over there and I'm over here. The symmetry's broken. There's an object, very primal, kind of embryonic. I mean, there's so little there. It's just a space. But the space does seem to be over there, whereas I'm over here. Right? And then the rest flows. Out of that, then, from that start to come appearances. With appearances come the manas, the mental cognition that differentiates. On the basis of that comes conceptualization, the labeling, the objectification, the subjectification. On the basis of that, reification. And then all mental afflictions. And have a nice samsara, because it will go on forever. But if we come back to that primal breaking of symmetry, the coagulation here, that's exactly what we're trying to move through, to basically subdue it, almost like putting our hand on its head. It's, down boy, down boy. I want to get behind you. I want to get around you in our shamatha practice. As we're rolling back this carpet, we want that to subside. Just go dormant, pipe down. I'm not going to realize emptiness or non-self at this point. I just want you to pipe down so I can move around you and come back and rest at home in that substrate consciousness. So this is why, in short, this is, I know, a bit of a reiteration from yesterday. This is why today we're calling out, calling forth, again, like pulling the curtain back on the Wizard of Oz. We're calling forth this first instance, as much as we can, of a sense of being in here, being something less than the agent who's doing, because we all know we can stop doing. We can just stop, just be there. But even when we're just being there, there's still a sense of being here, of being the observer, right? Even if you're not actively doing anything at all, still with this ahamkara, this eye grasper, or the klishtamana, the afflictive cognition, well, at least I'm here and not there. And so we're seeking to arouse that sense, to observe that sense, to see through that sense, and then the next step in that dissolution process is a substrate consciousness itself, your temporary terminus, the temporary goal, or the endpoint of shamatha practice. Now, just very briefly here, let's look at the macrocosm. This is the mini-cosm. This is just on a relative level. You've just come to the ground, the relative ground of your ordinary mind, the basis of your samsara, of your individual samsara, right? Which you slip into every time you fall deep asleep, and slip into every time you die, and so forth. But now, what's the bigger picture for which we can see analogs? And so I'm going to go right to Dzogchen, but my comments really are generically true for the Vajrayana presentation, Vajrayana in general, with a major dovetailing with Mahayana in general, and that is what is analogous to the substrate, the alaya. What's analogous to that on the ultimate, the transcendent level? What would be that space, but now an absolute space, the deepest possible level? And some of you already know. Dhammadhatu. Dhammadhatu, the absolute space of phenomena, identical to emptiness, shunyata, emptiness, identical to ultimate reality, dharmata. Dhammadhatu, the space out of which relative space-time emerges, the space beyond the space. Right. So that would be analogous. Right? Because there's no real limits to your substrate. You can't say, well, mine only goes out this far, or it's this big, and so forth. It's wide open. But now we've in the practice of Dzogchen, unlike shamatha, you're breaking through the substrate to Dhammadhatu. You're breaking through the substrate consciousness to primordial consciousness, also known as pristine awareness, rikpa. Right? And so as there is this kind of undifferentiated sense, when you're just resting in the substrate consciousness, an undifferentiation, a lack of differentiation between the substrate consciousness and the substrate, the space that it is illuminating, but with no object. Likewise, on this ultimate level, there is no real differentiating between the Dhammadhatu, the ultimate absolute space of phenomena, and primordial consciousness. They are primordially non-dual, primordially non-dual. And you're breaking through the relative, which is individuated, local, in time, in samsara, the basis of your samsara, right? To something now that is the ground of samsara and nirvana. So really ultimate, right? So one is a stepping stone to the other, but there's a strong analog there. Again, substrate consciousness analogous to rikpa, pristine awareness, or yishe, primordial consciousness, the substrate analogous to Dhammadhatu. On this ultimate level, they are absolutely and ultimately primordially undifferentiated, non-dual. On this relative level, experientially non-dual. Final point, and that is one of the most, I think, marvelous metaphors that runs through the Dzogchen tradition when comparing the psyche, so now we're back to coarse mind, and comparing that to rikpa, pristine awareness. Right? And I've seen this, His Holiness cited this metaphor, and I've seen it in Dujom Lingba, and I think it's really quite common, although I'm not very erudite, I'm not a great scholar of Dzogchen by any stretch of the imagination, but the teachings I have received are very good. And that is that the ordinary mind, which is so localized, and it has gender, and it has age, and ethnicity, and all of that, you know, and its personal history, and its hopes and fears, this ordinary mind, this is like water that is frozen. It's crystallized. Crystallized. Very discreet. Very, very discreet. There we go. Discreet not as in bashful or what have you, but discreet as in separate. Separate. Right? Whereas when you move from this your psyche and you go from there to rikpa, you're not achieving or gaining access to some other consciousness. But it's, and here's the metaphor, it's as if your consciousness melts and the melted state of your own mind, the fluid state of your own mind, is rikpa. So you don't look for rikpa someplace else. Like, I wish I could get rid of my mind so I could see the other one. It is your mind, but melted in its fluid state. And your mind is crystallized. So if your ordinary mind is like an ice cube, and Rigpa is like water in its fluid state, then the substrate consciousness is kind of like slush. Not that. Because when you're resting in the substrate consciousness, it's not completely non-conceptual. Little bubbles of concepts will come up. They won't set up a tsunami of repercussions and agitation and so forth, but they do still come up. So it's not completely non-conceptual. They say non-conceptual, not 100%. And likewise, another indication of kind of a subliminal or very covert, very quiet quality of grasping that occurs even in the substrate consciousness, and you may recall this, is the little tendril of grasping comes out of desire, attachment, clinging to any of the three qualities of the substrate consciousness. So as you're resting there, just enjoying having achieved shamatha, then a tentacle of grasping can come out, clinging to and preferring the bliss, saying, I really like this, I want to hold on to this. Or for some people, they'll be more inclined to be grasping onto, clinging to the luminosity, and others to non-conceptuality. People are different that way, just depending on the propensities that they already have that they bring to the practice. So one may gravitate, now that you've achieved shamatha, some may gravitate more towards, cling to the bliss, the luminosity, or the non-conceptuality, and that itself, of course, is a very quiet breaking of symmetry, because it's I want that. I don't want to be parted from that. So it's there. It's not completely absent. Right? So to break through that substrate consciousness, the tekchu, the breakthrough of substrate consciousness, you have to do something quite difficult, actually. And that is to release all preference for bliss, not bliss, luminosity, not luminosity, non-conceptuality, conceptuality. You need to release all preference. In other words, really complete relaxation. And then you break through the slush that's somewhat coagulated, somewhat differentiated. And then you go into Rigpa. So let's return to the practice. And I will give the guidance. I'll use fewer words because I think you pretty well know it now. We're coming just into the observer. But do this insofar as it's helpful, bearing in mind that the long run, that is where you're really going to be going, moving through that glowing ember is going to melt all the way down through the snowbank, is when you're just resting there. You're just doing nothing. And letting, in a way, in a manner of speaking, your psyche is melting down to the substrate consciousness. Or in another manner of speaking, your substrate consciousness is rising up to meet you. It's allowing itself to be discovered because you're not getting in the way. Right? So over the long term, that's where you're going to be going. That's going to be your, what do they call it, cruising altitude. That's where you'll stay the long time. But as you're getting liftoff, as you're getting there, if at times you find you're getting a bit jittery, either falling into laxity or excitation, then that's a time you may want to recommence the release, inversion. The release, of course, overcoming excitation, the inversion overcoming laxity. Okay? That was a lot of words. But now we come back to the practice. It really is simple. So I will use now few words, since I've front-loaded it. Then as we're actually doing it, I can use relatively few words. Looseness is the key. In terms of the path being similar to the fruition, the initial preliminary of settling the body, speech, and mind, or body, breath, and mind in their natural states, also is a facsimile of the culmination of the practice. So settle your body, speech, and mind for a little while. Now let your eyes be at least partially open. Rest your awareness evenly in the space in front of you with no object, not meditating on anything, simply being present without distraction, without grasping. As you withdraw, your interest, your attention, your faculty of knowing from all objects and all appearances, then you withdraw into a type of knowing that was already there prior to knowing anything else. And that is the knowing of being aware, the knowing of being conscious. Rest in that knowing. It's very simple. And it requires no thought. If you can allow your awareness to rest in its own place, holding its own ground, and you have the confidence that you are indeed resting in that knowing of knowing, without laxity, without excitation, then stay home and just be aware of being aware. If and when you begin to lose that confidence, feeling that you may just be sitting there with a blank mind, spacing out, or that you start getting caught up and carried away by thoughts, then it may be helpful to initiate the oscillation, withdrawing into that sheer, raw, unmediated experience of being conscious, inverting and concentrating, and then releasing out into space with no object. And likewise, insofar as you're still prone to the imbalances of laxity and excitation, you may, in the course of your oscillation, probe even more deeply. Probe right into your experience of being the observer, the one in here, the subject. And when you do so, simply observe what comes to mind. And observe it carefully. And then release. Invert and release. As you invert, see if you can penetrate right through the mirage-like appearances of I am. Penetrate through to the other side, the inside, beyond all appearances, to awareness itself. at your leisure in your own good time. Release the oscillation. Let your awareness come to rest in the center. And continue in the practice in utter simplicity, as we'll now do in silence. Hola, so. If I remember correctly, I think there was one hand up, maybe from Anna or maybe from Regina, at the end of the day yesterday. Do you recall? Anything lingering? Finished? That there was... Go ahead. You want to tell? As I recall, I was having a conversation with someone, and there was one final lingering one. I said, no, now we take a break, we have dinner. Was there one lingering one from yesterday? You forgot. Then that's good. That's no problem. Cecil? Okay, go ahead. Cecil.
Thank you. In picking up where we left off yesterday with settling the mind, that series of questions, there was the bashful maiden.
Quite so.
And I think you've also referred to it as like the stern father coming into the room and looking at the kids playing. And
also, much nastier image.
Playing, right? So there's a corollary effect, which is attachment. So if you put attention to the thoughts or images coming up in the mind, soft enough that they play out a little bit, but then to allow them to play out too long requires feeding them with grasping.
There's no such thing as letting them play out too long. There is such a thing as encouraging them to play out. So if you're really letting them, you're just letting them. Again, think about the grandma watching the other people's children play. She's not letting them go on too long or too short. She's just not doing anything. Their parents may let them, you can play here, you can't play there. The parents are involved. But the old grandma, she's just watching. So sometimes the children may play for a long time, sometimes for a short time. But now, so we finish with the metaphor, it's a subtle issue, and it's just one that has to be determined internally within your own experience. And you get that confidence that sometimes, just of their own accord, a thought may trickle on for a while and then just fades out. And you just have that confidence. I didn't make that happen. It just happened, right? And sometimes the thought may just dissolve quite quickly. And you have that confidence, I didn't terminate it. It just ran out of gas, right? But on other occasions, you may have that sense that I probably was bearing down a little bit too hard, because as soon as I started attending closely, then it got snuffed out. Or this one seemed to really start developing a narrative. I was probably getting locked into that one. So those words are easy, but then you just have to check internally to see, you know, as you're going to these gradations and gradations of grasping, both of aversion, both of intensity of gaze, where you snuff them out, or you prolong them because of a kind of grasping that you're interested, you don't want them to stop. Okay.
And related to that, so sometimes it feels like free association, but the free association feels to me like there is some sort of grasping. Oh, I'm pointing to the referent, and that makes me think of the similar situation, and then that's the next thought comes up from that. So when I...
Like an ice cream cone.
So when I pull back from that and have a... release the grasping, then I realize then the thoughts are more stochastic and kind of random.
That's exactly right. So I'm just going to paraphrase what you said. I don't use the word free association. I did for a very short time until I thought, wait a minute, this is what you do in Freudian analysis or Jungian analysis and so forth. You go into free association and it's exactly linking one thought to an image, to another thought, to a memory, to a desire, to an emotion, and so forth. And that which connects all of them is grasping. So this is no criticism of that as a therapeutic model. I mean, if it works, it works. I have nothing to say. But it's not settling the mind in its natural state. Because if you have these different beads of this thought, that image, this memory, what's the string that's connecting all of those beads is exactly the string of grasping. This reminds me of that. Oh, but that, I go into this association. Oh, but this is associated with that. Yeah, it's free association, but it's all grasping, right? And so as you quite rightly said, when you release that string, then we're using the same term, stochastic, nice word from physics, is that just more like fireworks, just like poof, poof, like that. You don't know whether they're going to be long or short. Sometimes there may be a little bit of loose connection, sometimes just popping up sporadically. Then you know, okay, it's really settling in its natural state. And that experience has been replicated for a good 1,000 years at least. Good. Okay, I'll read one. We don't have many today, just two, I think, left over from preceding days. And this is anonymous. So, according to what the Buddha taught, harmful actions arise from afflictive emotions, such as anger, fear, greed, and intolerance, which in turn come from dualistic and discriminative thinking. I'm going to interject just a little bit here as a translator. And that is the translation of klesha, or the Pali is kilesa, as afflictive emotions. It's quite common nowadays, and it's incorrect. There is a such thing as afflictive emotions, that's for sure, there's no question about it. But to translate, and I'm not even criticizing the question, but I am kind of introducing something I think actually is valuable. And that is, if we think of what are the three root, or the three poisons of the mind, the three fundamental mental afflictions, kleshas. It's delusion, craving, hostility. You can find different translations, but it's pretty much like that, right? Well, among those three, hostility or anger, that is an emotion. Craving is not an emotion. It's a cognitive state. It's a desire. But it's not an emotion. Delusion is not an emotion. So out of three, only one's an emotion. So to generically translate klesha as afflictive emotion is quite misleading, actually. Right? And those are just the three primary ones. Pride is not an emotion. If we go to the five poisons, envy, is that really an emotion? Probably not. It's more cognitive. I wish I had that. I wish you didn't have it. That's cognitive. It's about desire. Pride isn't an emotion. It's just me feeling I'm better. That's not an emotion either. That's cognitive. That's cognitive. Me better. I win. But that's cognitive. It's an afflictive cognition. So one sees actually, it's rather a minority of mental afflictions that are actually emotions. So very loosely speaking, to say afflictive emotions, okay, but it's actually not a good translation, okay? And this person never said it was a translation, but I thought I would interject that because it comes up an awful lot now. I, as a translator, read other people's translations. That's not a good one. It's not a good one because it takes only one slice of the pie and then says the whole pie consists of afflictive emotions. I don't think so. All I have to do is ask any psychologist. Is desire an emotion? Is envy an emotion? Is pride an emotion? Is delusion? How about ignorance? That's the mother of all mental afflictions. Is ignorance an emotion? I don't think so. Okay. And then this one also, which in turn come from dualistic and discriminative thinking. There's nothing wrong with it. That is all depending on how we define it. But discriminative thinking as discriminating and discerning. If you read a novel, and if you're really, you know, very, very highly educated in literature, and you read it, and then you give me an analysis. Imagine I'm your professor of literature, and you come as a postdoctoral student and said, I've just been reading James Joyce, and here's my analysis of it. If I should tell you, oh, that's a very discriminating analysis you gave. That's a very discriminating analysis. That's not insulting, is it? I don't think so. That means you've been very, very sharp. You've been very penetrating, very discerning. You recognize this, you saw that, you saw right through this. To be discriminating, that's not put down. To be discerning is not a put down either. That's very discerning. That was a very discerning analysis you gave of James Joyce, Ulysses. Yeah. So again, I think if we use words very carefully, that'll be helpful. And so dualistic grasping, yes. But if we say, okay, where do all these mental afflictions come from? They come from delusion of the misapprehension of reality, which of course includes dualistic reification of subject and object, right? And then one of the derivative mental afflictions is being judgmental in kind of the afflictive, nasty kind of way, self-judgmental, being judgmental towards other people. We know that's, as we're using that word in English, we know that's afflictive. It's very true. But to exercise sound judgment, no, now that we move to the noun, no problem. Move back to the adjective, oh, we have a problem. I mean, you're being very judgmental, but you're exercising very good judgment. Noun to adjective, big transition there. Okay? But the question is still perfectly good. Therefore, if we want to transform violence, fanaticism, and dogmatism in ourselves and the world, we need to cultivate openness and non-discrimination and non-attachment to views. Yes and no. Yes and no. Again, I'm picking with words here, but I think words are like knives. They can be very skillfully used, but sometimes they can wound. We certainly want to overcome these. Total agreement, violence, fanaticism, and so forth. We need to cultivate openness, very true, and non-discrimination. Well, all depends on how we define that term. You're showing, You're showing no discrimination at all. I mean, if we say racial discrimination, we know that. That's being judgmental, prejudicial, no question. But discrimination in English, at least, and I don't know how this translates into other European languages, you're showing very good discrimination here. You have a very good discriminating ability. That's not a put-down. That's not defective. And so I do have some concerns about the use of language here. And non-attachment to views, no question. That's one of the fundamental types of delusion, of grasping onto one's own views as supreme. If you look into the five types of delusion that lie at the root, that's one of them. Grasping onto one's own ritual practices as supreme, that's another one, right? But grasping onto one's own views as supreme, that is true. It's also, that is definitely an affliction. At the same time, but now let's just be careful with words. Attachment, well, by the very word in Buddhism, is a translation of a mental affliction. But now, if you know something to be true, if, for example, you know that if you drop a cell phone, it does not drop at constant velocity. It doesn't. It accelerates. Newton and other people came up with that. Okay? It accelerates. And you may know that. You may be a physicist. I mean, I ran those experiments when I was studying physics. There's certain things you know. You keep on running the experiment, and you keep on getting the same answer, and you say, you know, this is just true. You can disbelieve it if you like, hold any view you like, but this is actually true. The world is not up for grabs. I mean, let's just all vote, and you know, or everybody's opinion is equal. That's not a Buddhist view. That's kind of silly. Or let's just vote on it. How many people believe that falling bodies accelerate, and how many think they just go at constant velocity, and let's decide it that way. After all, we want to be democratic here. That's not how science works. That's not how Buddha Dharma works either. Some things are true. And so if you know that something is true, and then to hold to that truth is not an attachment to a view, it's knowing that something is true, right? So these are subtle issues. And it's easy to slip over into thinking that the reverse of afflictive discrimination and attachment to views is being totally undiscriminative and having no view whatsoever. That is, not believing anything is true, just saying, well, let's just be open. Whatever you believe, that's cool. Racist, sexist, and so forth and so on. But that's your view. I mean, who am I to differ? You know. So as we know, so many disputes between groups of people and individuals and even wars between nations come from attachment to their ideologies and ways of seeing things. There's no question about that. That's true. Certainly, religions have a long history of that. But then, if we go over to atheism, we find that atheists can be as intolerant as anybody else. Let's just take, for example, communist China. I don't know of any more intolerant, ideologically intolerant government than them, even to the present day. And they're not protecting some religious ideology. They're suppressing all the religious ones and saying, we have the only right view, and that's Marxism, or that's atheism, or whatever. So this is all true. But then this, of course, does lead to an equation. But this subtle distinction, and I think one needs to be very discriminating here, in the positive sense of the term. Where is the demarcation between attachment to an ideology and simply knowing something is true and standing by that truth? And if other people don't know that it's true, then from their perspective, you're just clinging to an ideology. But if you know it's true, you're not clinging to any ideology at all. You simply know something's true, right? So there's going to be multiple perspectives here. And other people may be really pissed off. I mean, I know at least one agnostic. I know at least one self-professed agnostic. And he's sure that nobody knows about certain issues. That's pretty phenomenal. If you actually know that nobody knows, then actually you know more than anybody. Because you know how much everybody in the universe knows, and you know this is where the limit is. In other words, doesn't that make you God? Or omniscient? So it looks kind of at first blush like humility, like after all, I mean, who knows? Of course, who knows? That's a good question. And then nobody knows. Except for I know that nobody knows. So this puts me above everybody else. I think one wants to be quite careful there. Agnosticism can just be sheer arrogance. So in which way or ways or to what extent the practice and achievement of this 10th stage of shamatha, will help the meditator to have no attachment to his or her own ways of interpreting or perceiving things? Is the shamatha training a way to transform and eradicate dogmatism, intolerance, and violence in ourselves and the world? Well, shamatha is designed to overcome attentional imbalances. That's what it's designed to do. It's not a panacea to cure all unethical behavior and all delusion and all ignorance in the world. In fact, it's not really, it's marching orders. The work order for shamatha is not to overcome delusion. It's to overcome attentional imbalances. And it's there as a servant. I said this at the very beginning of this retreat, that what I'm offering here is really intended as a servant to all other forms of meditation. Christian, Sufi, Buddhist, Taoist, Hindu, and so forth. Whatever type of meditation, and frankly, for every meaningful endeavor, but meditation in particular, and that is whatever meditation you're really drawn to, Vipassana or Dzogchen, Mahamudra, stage of generation, what have you, what I'm suggesting here, and with great confidence, is that if you have cultivated a mind that is at ease, that is stable and is clear, and you take that finely honed, finely tuned mind, and you apply it to any other kind of meditation, that meditation will go better. It's serving that meditation. Whereas if the mind that you're bringing to the more advanced types of meditation, Vipassana and so forth, if this mind is tight, if it's unstable, or it's dull, that meditation will go so well. Or as I've commented a number of times, through the practice of Vipassana, for Zen, Dzogchen, and so forth, if one is persevering or one is very gifted, you may have these spikes of insight where you really have something authentic. You penetrate through to a deeper dimension of reality. Your whole way of viewing reality suddenly shifts. It's a discontinuity. And suddenly you know this is a clearer vision. And it's not clinging to ideology or beliefs. It is actually you know something, like Galileo looking through his telescope, although this is much better. And so you have that shift. And you know this is a deeper view. This is more authentic, rather analogous to suddenly becoming lucid. And you know, oh, this is more authentic than being non-lucid. And then if you ask other people, they may feel, oh, you're just clinging to your ideology. You lucid ideology people. We just don't like you people because you're really weird and you say strange things. We, in fact, I think we should have to burn you at the stake, you know? And all you are is being lucid and know you're being lucid. It's not grasping to a view or an ideology, but you're just lucid. So there it is. But you may have these breakthroughs into lucidity, and a number of you have already found out, you can be lucid in a dream and then continue dreaming and lose your lucidity. And then you're right back into an ordinary, non-lucid dream. How does that happen? Because the mind was not sufficiently relaxed, stable, and clear. So you had a breakthrough into insight and then you lost it because you couldn't sustain it because shamatha was not there to back up your vipassana. So the role of shamatha is really subservient. It's humble. It's a servant to Vipassana, to Mahamudra, Dzogchen, and so forth and so on. So it by itself is not intended, was never designed, never pitched or presented or promoted as this is the cure to world's fanaticism and dogmatism and religious wars and so forth. It's just like all we're trying to do is make the mind serviceable. Serviceable. But now where is it rooted? Because this is not, we're not a bunch of Marines here learning how to become really good snipers. And now, as you point your gun, get really relaxed. Now get really still. Get very clear. Focus right between the eyes. Okay, really relaxed, stable, and clear. Good. Now pull the trigger and blow the person's brains out. That's not what we're here for, right? Somebody else may teach the Marines, but not me, right? And so where is our practice rooted? It's rooted in ethics, right? I mean, that came up from the very first day. It's rooted in nonviolence. It's rooted in benevolence. We're coupling this with the four immeasurables. So now consider if your baseline for every session of your shamatha practice is one of nonviolence. Nonviolence by way of body, nonviolence by way of speech, nonviolence by way of mind. And then it's motivated by loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity as you're roused into motion. And in that nest, then you're cultivating shamatha. Shouldn't that at least make you non-violent, non-fanatic, and so forth and so on? Whether it heals everybody else, that should be a step in the right direction. But you may, in the course of this, gain some insights. A number of you are, as you've been practicing just for 3 weeks. Some of you are gaining some very significant insights in the nature of your mind and so forth. When you gain those insights, you're not acquiring some belief. You're not getting indoctrinated by me and say, Alan, I now so believe what you said. You are so charismatic. You are so logical. You gave such good reasoning. Or you just quoted the Dalai Lama. That's good enough for me. And now I'm a believer. You know, nobody said that. That's not what we're here for, right? And so that distinction between having an insight and knowing it to be true versus simply holding a belief and clinging it to be supreme and then therefore insisting everybody else may be wrong, those are very different. Very different. So, will this help meditation to have non-attachment? Sure. Absolutely. It should help to have non-attachment at all things. Because as you're going into shamatha, approaching that substrate consciousness, you're releasing attachment to all hedonic pleasures altogether. Right? As you're approaching the form realm. And so, could this lead to non-attachment to his or her own ways of interpreting and perceiving things? Sure, it really should. But that doesn't mean you're going to become wishy-washy, not have any view at all. Is the shamatha training a way to transform and eradicate dogmatism? So I answered that. Not explicitly. That's what vipassana is for. But it should certainly soften things up. Intolerance, if one is really deeply immersed in this practice, shouldn't that make one more loose, relaxed? Violence, that has to do with ethics. That's foundational prior to, as the foundation of shamatha. So it's a very rich question, very nuanced question. I think it's worthy of very serious and very careful thought. So, let's come back to practice. Our time is so short. Questions, observations, insights pertaining to what we're doing right now. I want to do it, but not by this, but just by raising hands, and then I'll go. I'm trying to be utterly impartial here. That's why I don't just call on the person whose voice is up. Okay? So I'm just going to go over here, because that's the, I'm just going to try to be as even as I can. As impartial as I can. Okay, Joe.
Thanks. You mentioned just now distinguishing between awareness of awareness and having a mind that's just blank.
Quite so.
And spacing out.
Yes.
When I'm practicing, I think that I'm practicing awareness of awareness, and I certainly feel more present.
Yes.
And aware. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's something of a flavor of mind just blank there. I wondered, how do I know, how do I distinguish in practice that I'm on one side rather than the other of that divide?
It's internal. Yeah, it's a very good question. I remember when I was taught this practice by Genlam Rimba, the Tibetan yogi, when we lived together for a year back in 1988. He discussed this practice. And he said, when you first are just resting there in awareness of awareness, it's not going to be really crystal clear, sharp, man, did I get it. Like, whoa, like that. Like, it's no going to be a whoa. Kind of like epiphany. It's much quieter. It's just much quieter, right? More like just gradually seeing the sky in the east gradually lightening as the sun comes up. But it's quite gradual, right? And so there it is, just resting there and just having that sense, even though it's not flamboyant, having that sense, I'm not attending to anything else. I'm not attending to nothing. And I am attending to being aware of being aware. And knowing that's enough. Knowing that's enough. So this, as I've said before, this is the most discovery model, the most dominant in terms of discovery. It's not to say that we don't do anything to balance out. That's what the oscillation is for. But just there. And then it's allowing the greater clarity to dawn. The greater sharpness, the greater acuity of knowing, the greater clarity of the awareness, allowing that to dawn so it's inside. And if just subjectively speaking, according to your own parameters, this is the deal, it's your own parameters. When you sense, I think I'm getting a bit nebulous here, relative to other moments in the session or other sessions I've had, that may be a time when it would be good to start the oscillation again, just to sharpen it up a little bit, like almost like, you know? Instead of sharpening the blade of your attention, your mindfulness, on increasingly subtle thoughts, images, or increasingly subtle sensations of the breath at the nostrils, you're sharpening it by that inversion, sharpening, and then the releasing. The inversion and then releasing, like that, okay? But the short answer now is it's internal and it's relative. And seeing what's it like when you're really spot on, like yeah, I can't do better than this. You're not saying that, but you know it. Like, okay, let's just do it for 5 seconds. Yeah, that was good. Like that. Okay, so yeah, that was, I mean, I can't do better than that. And here's the real key. I don't need to do better than that. That's not shamatha, that's not 10th stage or whatever. But this is as good as it gets now, and as good as it gets now is good enough. And it will get better. Okay, cool. Good. Okay, I'm going to go back to written, and then we'll come over to the right-hand side of the room. Oh, yeah. This is from Lakshmi. So, how does lucid dreaming enhance shamatha practice through methods, mindfulness of breathing, settling the mind in its natural state, and awareness of awareness? What are the benefits of lucid dreaming? So, overall, I would say lucid dreaming doesn't enhance shamatha practice. I don't think so. I think it's pretty much one-way traffic. I can't say it doesn't influence it at all, but it's not designed to help you in your shamatha practice. The lucid dreaming practice is not designed to bring about greater sense of relaxation, stability, vividness, right? Any more than vipassana as such is designed to make you more relaxed, stable, and clear. It's designed to gain insight in nature of reality. Shamatha is not explicitly designed to gain insight in nature of reality. Settling the mind has some perks of that sort, but as a shamatha practice, its primary function is those three qualities, right? Conversely, though, as you do develop these qualities in your shamatha practice, if you can transfer them over to your dreaming state and you become lucid, and then as you become lucid, you have that little discontinuity, that breakthrough, and suddenly, ah, I am dreaming. That's the time, okay, what to do? Okay, first of all, relax. Don't get too excited and wake yourself up. Relax, easy, easy. And then, okay, now how about stability? I'd like to continue both the dream and my lucidity, both the dream and my awareness that it is a dream. I'd like to continue that stability. But then now that I'm in the midst of a dream, I'd like to have it be as, you know, HD, high definition, as vivid as possible. So this means I'm going to attend very closely, right? So your shamatha, all three of those modes, will help you sustain the dream and the lucidity with respect to the dream, and then be able to just open up that whole world of exploration, where, in a manner of speaking, within the dream, you're practicing vipassana, because in classic dream yoga. Because then, having gotten into that mode, sustained it with a sense of ease and continuity and clarity, now you're ready to go. Good. You just enter into the domain of the mind with all the lights on. Start exploring. And exploring is then vipassana within the dream. And that's a major aspect of dream yoga. Okay, so it's asymmetrical. What are the benefits of this? A lot can be said on a kind of the mundane or hedonic level. Stephen LeBerge has written at quite some length with a lot of insight, dealing with psychological problems, play acting within the dream, setting up scenarios that you couldn't in the waking state, evoking dead relatives. If there's some unresolved issues with dead relatives, invite them back. You know, why not? As a matter of fact, that they're dead, why should that bother you? You know, you can bring anybody back to mind that you can imagine. So, and then, of course, you can have all kinds of fun, and so he talks about that as well. But in the context, it's only the young people laughing. You notice that? Oh, yeah. Okay. Coming right back on. Dream yoga. Then what is the benefit? I could go on for the whole time, but I'm going to try to cut it short. Speaking the Buddhist framework, okay? Lucid dreaming, read Stephen LeBerge's excellent book, Exploring the World of Lucid Dreaming. He elaborates on that theme, I think, to your heart's content. That's a really good job. It's an outstanding book, okay? But now dream yoga, okay, now this is another kettle of fish, okay? So what's the point of dream yoga? Not just becoming lucid, staying lucid, but practicing dream yoga and starting to explore the nature of the mind, the nature of consciousness itself. Well, speaking now within Buddhist framework, if you start developing the habit, becoming adept at becoming lucid, more deeply, deeply becoming lucid, more thoroughly fathoming the nature of dream reality, so you can do that on a regular basis, then this is a marvelous preparation for the bardo. Because in the bardo, overall, when people are in the bardo, especially the earlier phases of it, they don't know they're in the bardo. They're not aware of that. And being ignorant of being in the bardo, they mistake it for something else. Like still being alive. And that can be very frustrating. Okay? And so to recognize the bardo as the bardo, as you recognize the dream as the dream, then it's very, very empowering, very liberating, because now you can draw on your wisdom. Ah, I'm dead. And it's not lights out. Fancy that. I now am holding the view that death does not entail termination. And I'm not attached to it. I know it. Too bad I couldn't tell all the folks back home. They might want to know. But I see dead people. But now that you know, then you know, aha, the bardo is not just happening to me. I can direct it. I can now arouse my most meaningful aspirations. I can take this arrow of my awareness moving through time, and like a good archer, I can direct it where I'd really like to go in the most meaningful way. That can be very freeing, very, very freeing. So that's a big one. That's a major reason why Tibetans will practice dream yoga. Since they're all going to be dying, they'd really like to be in the bardo lucidly, recognizing the bardo as the bardo. That, again, as in the dream, is very freeing. Because now you see things are not just happening to you and you're the victim. You can start transforming this bardo at will. And that's very, 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 very good. But beyond that, even in this lifetime, and with or without belief in continuity of consciousness beyond death, with setting that aside, see, you don't know, okay, big deal. Here you are in this lifetime. At the very least, you can explore with between the two aspects of consciousness, phenomenologically speaking, in the Buddhist view, which I think is true. I don't think I'm attached to it. I just find it to be true. It's not the same. They're not the same, to be attached and find something to be true. Within this context, consciousness has two qualities. It's luminous, that is, it makes manifest. It makes manifest appearances, and it's knowing. It's clear and knowing, luminous and knowing. Well, part of the clear or luminous aspect is the creative aspect of consciousness. Consciousness doesn't just look, and see. Consciousness creates a lot. As in the dream, everything you're seeing there is a configuration of consciousness emerging from the substrate. So as you explore that, the malleability, the whole nature of the dream phenomena, the appearances of all kinds arising in the dream, you explore that. You explore the extent to which it can be transformed at will. You explore whether anything is resistant to your imagination or to designation. You see whether within the dream anything is inherently existent. You're definitely moving into insight, or moving in the direction of insight into emptiness, shunyata, right, within the dream. So that's exploring the creative aspect and the emptiness of appearances in the dream. But then at will, within a matter of seconds, you can just stop in the middle of a dream. Stop everything. Stop engaging. Stop moving. Stop acting. You even close your eyes in a dream. And within seconds, the whole dream will disappear. And you will move from the dream consciousness into dreamless sleep. And if you maintain your lucidity, the knowing quality, then you can be resting in the substrate conscious knowingly without having achieved shamatha. You're getting a sneak preview. It won't be as brilliant as, as unmediated, as unveiled, as naked, as if you got there through the whole trajectory of shamatha. But you are accessing the substrate consciousness just by dissolving the dream and maintaining your lucidity as you fall into dreamless sleep. So, but now as you're resting in that substrate consciousness, there's kind of not much happening, if anything, happening in terms of appearances. The luminosity, the luminous aspect of consciousness has gone pretty dormant. But there you are, still knowing. Really raw, naked, unmediated, just knowing. So now you're exploring the other aspect of consciousness. So I've often said that a lucid dream is the perfect laboratory for studying the mind and consciousness itself, because everything you're experiencing consists of nothing other than configurations of the mind. Right? So that's a perfect lab. Physicists get to go to physics lab, and everything is composed out of physical stuff. Throw a rock in any direction, it's bound to bounce off of something that's physical. So that's great. If you're a physicist, the whole lab, including your body, is all made out of physical stuff. Move into a lucid dream, everything is made out of mental stuff. So it's very good for that. And then, of course, you may penetrate from the dream as the launching pad, the lucid dream as a launching pad. You may release into the substrate consciousness. And there, resting in the substrate consciousness, you may, if you wish, practice Dzogchen or Mahamudra, and then break through into Rigpa. So that's why the dreaming state is said to be one of six bardos. I won't go through the whole list right now, but each one of those six can be a launching pad for enlightenment, to awaken. So if one is very gifted, as I heard of, I wish I could have met him. I didn't have the opportunity. But back in 1992, when he had this marvelous conference called Sleeping, Dreaming, and Dying at His Holiness's residence in Dharamsala, we invited, and then the communication just broke down. It was just one of those things. But there was one yogi in Shimla, in northern India, that his primary practice was dream yoga. Very accomplished. And he would dream as much as he could. He would sleep as much as he could. Day or night, he would just try to sleep. Oh, where's my meditation cushion? And the meditation cushion was, you know, sleeping away. Because he was so good at it that he could practice stage of generation, he could practice stage of completion, he could practice Dzogchen, he could do everything. And without the encumbrance of having this big, smelly, yucky body. Because the only body he had in the dream was a dream body, and that's quite pure. Okay? So that's a long answer to a short question. But let's go on. During awareness of awareness practice, I breathe through the mouth. This leads to a smoother passage of the air, but every now and then I need to swallow my saliva. I was wondering, I'm glad you put in saliva, not having a little stack of bonbons here. Just saliva. Else I drool like great Danes. Yes, it's a pretty vivid image. I've seen it, like a big icicle thinking, oh. St. Bernards are very good at that too. Sometimes a double waterfall. So I know what you mean. Quite embarrassing. Try being a Dharma teacher. And you can imagine if you're a Dharma teacher like that and you're teaching up in Tibet at 5,000 feet and it's really cold. Fu Manchu. Little frozen icicles of saliva dripping out. Very embarrassing. You don't want to see that. Oh, yeah. So there we are. So, else I drew like Great Danes. This physical movement of swallowing disrupts the smoothness of the meditation process. How not to salivate and not need to swallow? It's a perfectly good question. And you're not the first one to ask it. Because people have been doing this for a long time. I know, if I give a really, really quick analogy. Rarely, but on occasion, when I'm sitting upright in an airplane, I'll fall asleep if I'm really, really tired. But I have to be really tired to fall asleep sitting upright, because normally I don't. But when that does happen, it's really not pleasant to look at. You fall asleep, the jaw muscles relax. You know, so there. I look really. People should take a photo of me then. This is our meditation teacher. And then if there's drool, all the better, you know? And so, as in falling deep asleep, well, going deeply into meditation, you know? You're slipping into the substrate when you go deeply into shamatha, and when you fall asleep, you're going into the substrate. Either way, the jaw muscles relax, and also saliva may roll. So, as long as you're still, you know, aware of your body, the only answer I've heard to this one is a technique from Tibetan Buddhism I've heard, and that is let your tongue, when you're going into the meditation, let your tongue lightly touch the palate, the roof of the mouth. And you have your mouth just slightly open. So this is just classic, the kind of the fine tuning of posture. But there you are. So all the rest of the points are there. And then so just a little crack here. Whether or not you're breathing through it, and you're breathing through the mouth, so that's fine. So, and it's big enough. You don't have to open your mouth wide to breathe through the mouth. A crack is still quite big enough. But just having the tongue touched there, you might try that. And then, of course, the other solution is the supine position, and then problem solved. Okay. And a final one: in the attention revolution, you suggest to use vas breathing during awareness of awareness. What is vas breathing? Very good. Let's come back to that later, when we're actually doing the meditation. Okay, it's called the gentle vas breathing, and I do not recommend it for mindfulness of breathing, but it can be equally used in settling the mind in its natural state as well as shamatha without a sign, for both of those. And some practitioners, and I was told by my guru, the Venerable Gyatri Rinpoche, that his guru, Dujum Rinpoche, would do the vas breathing a lot just throughout the course of the day. He would maintain the vas breathing. So very, very briefly, it's just holding a roundness of the belly as you breathe in and out. But a pot shape, kumbha. Is it called kumbha in Sanskrit? Kumbha, I think it is. Just a pot shape, a pot belly. That's the short answer. But the long answer, very soon, either tomorrow or the next cycle, in settling the mind. Then we'll go to this. I'll teach it briefly. It's something that can be helpful. Some people find it very helpful. Some people don't. It's not indispensable, but it can be helpful. Good. So, from the floor, yes, we'll go to... I haven't heard from Guy for a while. Okay, so I'll go to Guy first.
Awareness of awareness. Yeah. As I practice that, I tend not to have much sense of... very little sense of location in space.
Quite so, yeah.
But as I move to the oscillation, I kind of... I feel I require some sense of location to invert into something. And initially I was, I think, inverting into the head, but that felt a bit tense. So then I moved to like a kind of contraction of the field of experience, contraction and expansion. But something's not quite right. I wondered if you could say something around the spatial dimension.
You're right, you're quite right, yeah. It's very good. And that is when you're really resting there, awareness holding its own ground, there really isn't much of a sense, if any, of space, of big, small, in front and back, and so forth, because the whole idea was that you're withdrawing your awareness from all appearances, including the appearance of space. Right? So bar none, no sign at all. Space is a sign. Space is something you can attend to, as we do in settling the mind in its natural state, the space, the intervals between thoughts. So here we're seeking to withdraw from all of that. And so if you can just rest there, and you're not bewildered and not getting foggy, spacey, trance-ish, and so forth and so on, then just stay there. That's fine. That's cruising altitude. And just be there and then go to the substrate consciousness, where once you're resting in the substrate consciousness, once again, you don't have a sense of locality or space, like, oh boy, it's really spacious in here. No, because you've withdrawn from in here into here. You're just there. Right? But now, should you wish to, return to the oscillation, either into awareness itself, into the agent who's releasing and retracting, or into the observer who's just quietly there inside. If you wish to go into that, then it's not a matter of finding an object, finding, okay, where's that space that I should expand into? Because that would be then just going from shamatha without a sign to shamatha with a sign, right? Which we're not gonna mess it up that way. So this is why the closest analogy I can give, or kind of step up, like step up into a carriage, a little stepping stone I can give you, or a step ladder, is the one I gave earlier of listening very closely to that sound way off to your left. Now, we don't need to do it right now, but when we did that, you didn't need to visualize space. At least, it's not necessary. You may have done it, but it's not necessary. Your attention's just there. That is, and I'm not picking up anything. That is, I just did it. I mean, it's not hard. But I just was checking out, can I hear any sound, distant sound, way off to my right? I'll try again. Nope, I can't. I hear the nearby noise of the air conditioning, but that's all. But that was it. It was just releasing, but there was no object. But I went far away, but I didn't hit some target far away. I just went far away. I don't know how far. But if it had there been a distant sound, I think I would have heard it because I was attending in the right place. Right? Something like that. Right? But again, resort to that when you find it helpful. But when you're just resting, as in the earlier conversation with Joe, when you're resting there holding your own ground, if you're confident, then there's no reason to move elsewhere. Go ahead.
I think it was more actually the inversion as I...
Acha.
Yeah. Kind of coming into, inverting into something.
And here the, what are they? Prepositions? Inside, outside, in, out. They can be misleading. Because when we say in, I saw you point to your head. Okay, now I'm going to come into probably behind my eyeballs. That must be where in is. Like that. Right? It's not. And it's not there. And it's not anywhere. Because if it's here, or if it's here, that's an appearance. That is, above my head, that's an appearance. If I think, okay, inside my head, that's an appearance. I say, well, okay, how about inside my heart? That's an appearance. As soon as you place it here or there, you've placed it within an appearance. But what this is doing is withdrawing from all appearance, sensory and mental. So that's what in is. That is, and it's not, it's it's terminology used in the classic text, so they're not, and they choose their words very carefully. But you can see, if I'm just sitting here, I'll do it right now. And then now what? So I was just sitting there, kind of minding my own business. And then suddenly you caught my attention, or I deliberately focused. You have a sense of my coming out to greet you. You have a sense of my attention coming out and eye to eye, man to man, face to face, mano a mano. You know, and I'm coming out, because you're not in here. You're not inside my head. You're not in here at all. You're out there. But out there just means in the field of appearances. That's all it really means. Because I can also visualize you out there. I'm visualizing you right now. I've closed my eyes and I'm visualizing you being 15 feet away from me, in front of me. Hello, guy. I hope you're still there. Well, yeah, pretty close. And so both of those are coming out. Neither one was inside the head. And so you've touched a very important point, very subtle point, that we mustn't take the words inside, outside too seriously, very literally, as if I'm coming outside of my head and inside of my head, or outside of this place and going to that place. It's simply a withdrawal from all appearances. But when you've withdrawn into appearances, and this came up earlier, in fact, you came up with it earlier, when you're just resting in awareness of awareness, you don't really have any sense of location at all, neither being here nor there, nor being surrounded by some kind of space. Because that's exactly what you've withdrawn from, the sense of being here or there, and the sense of there being surrounding space that you're still kind of giving a wink and a nod to, you're still attending to. As much as possible, you are single-pointedly withdrawing from all appearances, and we will call that going in. But even there, the words are misleading. But with withdrawing from all appearances, that's not misleading. And then when we release, in a manner of speaking, it's releasing beyond all appearances. So you're not going out to appearance as a target and hitting it. It's kind of going, and then just no appearances at all. But that sense of total abandon, total release, total, but with no target. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. If there's one short one on the left-hand side, okay? Don, you're up. Very good. And we'll come back to you, Andres. We'll come back on Monday.
This is related, actually, to the saliva question.
Survival?
The saliva.
A saliva question.
Okay, and it is
much
that... And it is that it's about breathing.
Uh-huh.
When I release, when I get to the end of the breath, if I actually leave the breath out for a moment, there seems to be a deepening of my awareness.
Of course.
And as soon as I begin to breathe again, it diminishes.
Right.
And so at each kind of release, at the end, if I stop for just a second, I get a different taste. Mm-hmm. So that's...
Yeah. There's a skill that can be acquired during these 8 weeks. And if one acquires it, it can be a keeper that will serve you well for the rest of your life. And if it's not acquired, the lack of acquisition of that skill can actually be an obstacle to your meditation indefinitely. And that's learning how to breathe. Learning how to relinquish all control over the breathing. Learning how to let the body breathe without messing with it, without interfering. Not interfering any more than as if you were deep asleep, and then you're really not interfering, and that's the most restorative breathing that takes place in a 24-hour period, I believe. That's my belief. Now, having said that, I'm going to come back to the question. I believe that. Do I know that? No, I don't. I don't. Maybe it's not true, but that'll be my working hypothesis, and I have no zeal to try to persuade other people it's true. I'm saying that's my sense, that's my intuition, but it's a belief, not a knowledge. Therefore, I will not stand by it. I know this. It's intuition. I believe it. But now if some sleep specialist, and man, a lot of them really know their stuff, and I'm not a sleep specialist, you know, a sleep scientist. If some sleep specialist comes along and said, Alan, we study this, and in fact, it's not true what you believed. No, here's the evidence for it. I say, oh, okay, good. You know something I didn't know. In which case, I will no longer hold that belief. Okay? So there's subtleties here. The point there is you allow it to stay out. What I would suggest, if you're a parent and you say, okay, children, I'm allowing you to stay in this room, you're still exerting control. Because that means I can relinquish this allowance anytime I like. Children, you're no longer allowed. I gave you a right, but now I'm taking it back. And in this practice, we're releasing the allowance. we're just letting it go altogether. And that is, we're not letting it stay out, we're just releasing it. Now you point, and it's a very good point, it's one I've also found, discovered from my experience, this one I think I know, and that is, as you come to the end of the breath, as you just let it be, just release, there is a deepening. But now, if some really like little iota of anxiety comes in, some neediness, I think I better breathe in now, that breaks it. Now ego's coming in, now exertion is coming in, effort's coming in, and that breaks it, and then you come back to the shallow end of the pool. If you can continue to release, and I've said this many times, but I'm happy to say it again, you release, and you release, and you release, until you've given it all away. And then you don't pull, and you don't take. And then the breath is given. And you don't need to take it. And in fact, for you not to receive it, you would have to exert effort to keep it out. But you're not going to do that. Right? So then you don't lose it. Then you can relax, psychologically at least. You can relax as deeply as you're breathing out and even coming to the end of the out-breath. Release, release, release. And then you continue to release. That is, utterly letting go, even as the breath is flowing in. And then you don't lose that deepening. Okay? That's that sweet spot. And that's just, by the way, why when I'm teaching counting the breaths, for some time, I think it was years ago by now, for sometimes when I was teaching counting breaths, I said, when you come to the very end of inhalation, of exhalation, just before the inhalation flows in, one, count one. And then some people pointed out, and I confirmed with my own experience, that ruins the sweet spot. It ruins the sweet spot. Right there when you want to be totally shut up, don't mess with it. You say, one, thanks, I need, oh. Just when I wanted it silent, you had to say, one, could you please put a button, you know, put a zipper on it. I want to just be quiet there and go deeper and not, oh, yeah, throwing gravel. So at the end of the inhalation, it's not quite the same. And if inhalation, okay, you're just about to release anyway. So just before you release, one, and then down the slide, okay? Okie dokie. See you around. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Maria. I'll see you on the way out. Yeah? Oh, Lasso. Enjoy your evening. Thank you.